Okay, so first off, please tell us your name, your position at the ECCC, and a brief summary of what you're doing there.
My name is Niveda Thiru. I was a legal consultant in the Office of the Co-Investigating Judges, and my role was basically to support the International Co-Investigating Judge and his team in the conduct of the judicial investigations in cases 3 and 4.
All right. And what brought you to the ECCC in that role?
I was interested in working in international criminal law, and in particular, I wanted to see how international criminal law worked or could be applied in an Asian context. And the ECCC was a very natural choice for that.
Right. So tell us a bit about what you did as a legal consultant there. What were some of the challenges you faced? Or if you could give us a sense of kind of what your day-to-day was like, that'd be great.
Yeah. In my day-to-day role, I would review motions that would be filed by the parties during the investigation and draft decisions for the judge. I would advise the judge and the investigating teams on legal and procedural aspects of the investigation, and this required a lot of legal research and drafting. And so in that day-to-day role, there were several challenges, I guess, one of which was that there was just a lack of Cambodian jurisprudence on criminal law and procedure. In the ECCC, we applied not only international crimes, but also domestic crimes. And for the domestic crimes, there was a paucity of information. Another challenge was understanding different legal systems. The ECCC is obviously a hybrid tribunal and combines elements of the civil law system, which drew heavily on French criminal procedure, and also aspects of common law systems. It was also difficult to understand at first the perspective of colleagues who came from different legal backgrounds. At the ECCC, we worked with often very limited resources due to budgetary constraints, not just staffing resources, but also with IT support, translation services, having access to a legal library. These were quite limited compared to, I think, what you might see in other tribunals that had more guaranteed funding. There was also, with staff, a lot of uncertainty with staff and consultant positions. And I think this affected staff retention and therefore the rate at which things could progress.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit more about the hybrid court aspect of this. What were some of your thoughts on the positive and negative aspects of having a hybrid court?
I think one of the most positive things about the hybrid system is that it involves the contribution of both national and international staff, and that allows for a better exchange of perspectives and ideas. Having international staff involved and having them based in the situation country means that they're exposed to the affected population and they're exposed to the local language and culture, and that helps them better understand the context of the cases. And I think hopefully it gives a shared sense of ownership and responsibility between the international community and the affected country for achieving accountability for mass atrocity crimes that have happened in that country. On the downside, though, hybrid courts can be, I think, difficult to work out a good balance between the national and the international component and to secure very effective cooperation to make meaningful outcomes. And I think they can often be tainted with accusations of bias or lack of independence. And this just distracts from the quality of the work and distorts the public's perception about the utility of such courts.
Gotcha. That is helpful for us to know. So looking forward a little bit, are there any lessons learned or best practices or recommendations that you got out of your time at the ACCC that might be helpful for future tribunals?
Yeah, I definitely think future tribunals should be based in the affected country or as close as possible nearby. I think having the exposure to the language and the culture is really important because those shape the way people perceive things, and that therefore shapes the narrative of events. So basing the tribunal in the affected country ensures that international staff have the appropriate exposure and therefore understand the narrative in a way that makes sense to the local population. And at the end of the day, having a local population understand what's going on is the most important thing. I think it's necessary when setting up a hybrid tribunal to try and foresee all possible hindrances to the cooperation between national and international cohorts, and assuring that there are effective mechanisms in place to resolve them and to allow the proceedings to reach a satisfactory conclusion. These tribunals need a bigger, more guaranteed budget. For example, one of the things that was very much needed in the ECCC was a greater translation budget. We had a very good translation team, but they just needed more resources. We needed timely translations in both the local language and the working language. And this was essential to ensure that filings could be issued simultaneously so that not only the lawyers, but the accused could understand what was going on, and to ensure that the proceedings could happen at a reasonable pace. These tribunals also rely a lot on the work of interns who are unpaid. And I think that can be a limitation. We need to be able to support more interns from less developed countries to work in tribunals, such as by offering them stipends. This will help diversify the pool of lawyers who work in these tribunals and I think strengthen the application of ICL to the various regions of the world.
Well, thank you. Those are some great things to think about. If you don't mind, if we can kind of, I'd like to hear a little bit more of the details of how the lack of resources for the translators in particular, but perhaps also for legal interns, if you'd care to speak to it. Are you able to give us any examples of where those sorts of things became a problem?
Yes, they usually in these proceedings, you have judges who issue decisions, and then from the time that you issue a decision, there's a certain amount of time running for the parties to file an appeal. And it's usually provided for in the rules that appeals will start running from the date on which both the original language and the translation into the next working language is made available. And if there's a lapse of time of weeks or months between the original being filed and the translation, then you've given the parties quite a bit of uncertainty as to when a matter will become, when the appeals clock will start running. And you certainly don't want those timing differences to vary as well between the different cases, so that each accused has a different amount of time, essentially, or their legal team has a different amount of time, effectively, to file an appeal. So we would have that issue every now and then. In terms of funding interns, well, funding interns was just not available at the ECCC. So it just meant that we couldn't really broaden the pool of interns very much beyond those coming from typically Western nations. In terms of staffing as well, it meant that there were some times when it was just not clear to us whether the staff in the office would be funded beyond a particular month. And that would then require the management of the office to then engage in very serious diplomacy and negotiations to try and secure donations from the donor countries. And this obviously took their time away from doing the work of the investigations.
Gotcha. Thank you for sharing all that. I could certainly see how that would be an issue. Thinking a little bit more about future courts, what challenges do you see for courts in the future who are handling mass atrocities based on your work here at the ECCC?
Yeah, I think that the main challenge really is securing consistent and steady political support, primarily from the situation country, to ensure the ability to effectively investigate, to arrest suspects, and to prosecute individuals who were operating at senior levels. That will always be the biggest challenge. And secondly, I think being able to secure guaranteed funding to properly staff and resource the courts. I think those are two eternal challenges for these hybrid tribunals.
Sure, that definitely makes a lot of sense. So talking a bit more about the trials themselves and keeping within the boundaries of what has been released to the public, of course, can you recall any accused or survivor stories that particularly resonated with you?
Yeah, I would say rather than talking about a survivor story, survivors who were witnesses at the court, actually, what resonated with me was having colleagues, Cambodian colleagues working in the OCIJ, who had gone through life under the Khmer Rouge and had experienced all kinds of horrendous things and had lost family members, and yet here they were decades later working to try and achieve some justice and to achieve some positive outcomes for their country. And just seeing every day their commitment and their positivity, and to be honest, their stories were stories I didn't learn really until my second or third year into my role there. They were very, very dignified about what they had gone through. And I think this is a common attitude that you would see in the witnesses who came forward to give evidence as well. Their stories just infused the proceedings with humanity, but also working with these colleagues infused the work with humanity.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's something I hadn't quite thought of in the courts, but absolutely makes sense. If I might ask, do you think it was challenging for them to, you know, have to revisit some of these experiences that they went through?
Yeah, it had to have been. It absolutely had to have been. While we would have conversations about what they had experienced, it never quite got to the stage of talking about the psychological impact that it had had, or that that revisiting it through the work had had on them. But I definitely got the sense that there was a strong commitment to trying to put things right again. And I thought they were incredibly brave for it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So looking down the road then, what do you think the major impacts of the ECCC will be for them on Cambodian society, both now and say 20 years in the future?
I think it's given the country an opportunity to confront its history. Often we would get witnesses who would say at the end of their interviews that they were happy to have the opportunity to tell their story because their grandchildren didn't quite believe what had happened to them. So I think having now built this record of documentation and witness statements detailing what happened during the era of the regime is really important, and the courts had a very good outreach program to try and to spread the work of the court throughout the country. I think it's given the victims the ability to speak more openly about what they experienced, and this has been particularly useful in relation to issues that remain stigmatized, such as the forced marriages that took place during the regime. I hope it's given the victims a sense of justice or the feeling that they have been heard somewhere. And on a more practical legal level, I think it's contributed to the jurisprudence that can now be relied upon in Cambodian criminal law.
Great. Thank you so much for that. Before we wrap up, is there anything we haven't talked about that you think we should or that you would like to say?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, great. Well, then, thank you very much.